All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? How's it going? I'm Mark Maron. Mark, M-A-R-C, Maron, M-A-R-O-N, 92763. That's when I was born. What am I doing? Just reeling off details? What's happening? I'm not trying to apply for something. I don't have to prove who I am to you. Do I? You want to see my ID, huh? Do you? Wow. How's it going? I know for some of you, we're coming down to the wire on this Christmas business, and there's a lot of panic and fear in the world. The new strain is upon us, ripping through the population. I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. I did everything I could. I did everything I could. I called the people, and I guess there was just no stopping it. There could have been, but there's a dummy problem. I don't need to rail about that. I'm boosted. Hope you're boosted. Hope you're getting your family to see the light a little bit. Peter Jackson. Yes, he's on the show. This show today. Peter Jackson was on the show from New Zealand. He's the Oscar-winning director of The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, King Kong. And now the Beatles Get Back. We talk a bit about his whole career. But a lot of this talk is focused on the Beatles and Get Back and wrangling that project. Good interview, a lot of stuff, a lot of questions answered about the process of working with the Beatles in the way that he did. All right? What else can I tell you? I had a dream, and I rarely remember them, but this one I remember. I was on a big, fancy sort of like, it seemed like a luxury liner giant jet. And that was the idea. It was this huge plane, but it didn't look like a plane. It just looked like this huge, you know, kind of like beautifully decorated, dark, oaky situation. A lot of nice furniture around. Huge, though. But in my dream, I was under the understanding that this was an aircraft. And somehow or another, I was seated with a fairly lofty bunch of artists. I don't remember who was there, but I remember it was not quite my crowd, but I was sort of happy to be there, to be accepted amongst the high-minded art crowd. And then my ex-girlfriend, Sarah, showed up. I saw her walk in, and she was with some people, and she saw me. She's like, I'm not dealing with this. And, you know, she was going to walk away. She was clearly just not going to engage with me, but I was trying to be charming and sort of like, can we put it behind us a bit and just be like people and talk? Can we do that? But it sort of wasn't happening. And then this giant vessel takes off and I can't feel it flying. It's making me nervous. It seems too big to fly. So then I go out a door. Apparently there's a deck on this aircraft, and then I find that it's a boat. And I'm at the back of the boat outside on some sort of what do you call them on boats? Deck. There's a guy there smoking. It's a smoking deck. And I'm like, this is a boat. He's like, yeah. And then like I'm looking in the water at this giant propeller under the water that's not moving. And I'm like, how are we moving? And then somehow or another, almost intentionally, I drop my phone into the ocean. And I had that moment where I'm like, fuck, that's done. Now I got to deal with reality. I got to really be in the present. Like I had this feeling like there goes my phone. And then there was a minute like, well, what if somebody finds it? And it's like, dude, it's at the bottom of the ocean. No one's going to find it till years and years from now. Perhaps if the ship sinks right then, they'll find it when they excavate. But either way, I'm like, man, now I've got to lock in. What the hell am I going to do? And then I had this realization in the dream that there's nothing that I have to do. The phone's not going to make my life that much different other than people can't get in touch with me. Then I started to wonder, like, did I bring my computer? Because I could do the find your phone thing. And then I realized, like, what the hell is that going to give you? You just want to see if it works for the bottom of the ocean? And that was the extent of it. I'll take any input. I usually kind of break down my own dreams, but I'm putting it out there. Wasn't a plane, turns out. Giant boat. I guess I could tell you about the Comedy Store the other night. It seems that I've got to regroove, you know, get my the hour that I built heading into New York back up on its feet. But like I keep doing these short sets at the store, which is fine. The other night I had a set in the main room and then a set in the original room. And it was just one of these nights where the main room was great. Bunch of sweet people. And somehow or another, that makes me kind of edgy. When all the comics walk into the dressing room after their set and say, like, God, what a great crowd. I'm like, oh, fuck. It's an odd response, but it's true. And I don't know why I think that. I guess I don't want to know that. I just want to know they're attentive people. I'm not sure what I'm looking for. But my impulse inside of me when someone says it's a great crowd is that, like, no, fuck it up. I'll ruin it. We'll see. We'll see. It's always like a bad omen somehow in my brain when comics say great crowd. It was good, though. I did all right. My shit's a little dark right now, but that's the way it goes. Dark times. So then I go down the hall to the original room, and that audience was awful. Like, awful. But I was kind of, I've been doing so much comedy. If this is like an actual breakthrough in a way, where you realize that no matter how long you've been doing this or how good you've gotten at it, that on some level, it's going to come down to the material, number one. And also, it's going to come down to the audience. It just is. I'm not one of these people that's sort of like, there are no bad audiences. There's definitely bad audiences. No doubt. And I got up there with all the confidence of having just killed in the big room. And I got nothing. Like, I did my first few things and I was like, nothing. Like, just sort of like, nah. And it was a pretty full room. And just kind of like, nah, not nothing. You know, like maybe a polite guffaw from a couple of people. And I know what that's like. You know, it all comes back to you in that minute where you're like, oh my God, I've just grounded myself in fucking failure. I'm just like, this is what this is going to be. I've done this a long time. I know exactly what's happening. They're not going to give me fucking anything. Why? I don't know. Sometimes audiences don't come together. They just don't materialize as a group. But the truth is, it got going and I did find the people that were laughing in the room, and it was enough and it was interesting to just cleanse myself, baptize myself in the waters of tankage, in just the vacuum of the classic tank. And there's no sort of more present feeling than sitting up on a stage, having just told a joke that usually gets laughs, to nothing. And just sort of like, wow. And you feel your heart kind of cringe and crinkle around the edges. And the great thing was I realized, like, yeah, this happens, man. Enjoy it. Lean into the tankage. This is part of the job. And at the end of the show, I pointed out a guy in the middle of the room who sat there, who for some reason my gaze was upon, because he was sort of in the center of the audience, in the center of my vision. He was just sitting there, middle-aged guy, and his wife had his arms crossed and just looking at me, gave me nothing. Nothing. I didn't feel like he was doing it on purpose or he's trying to fuck with me. I don't even think that he knew that I could see him, but I did tell him at the end of my set, I said, you, sir, in the middle of the room, are the worst audience member I've ever had in my entire career. Right up there. Just fucking awful. You. Everybody laughed at that. But in that moment, I was kind of serious. But the question is, was he really? Do you ever know what they're thinking about? No. Could it have had something not to do with me? Yes. Did it feel good to say that to him? Him being a representative of a pretty fucking lame audience? It did. Was it worth it? Absolutely. Absolutely. Peter Jackson, man. Now, you guys know how I felt about this Beatles thing. I'll say it again. I say I feel like I've known them all my life. They were exactly like I thought they would be. And this was just the first time I got to hang out with them. I really was immersed. It changed my entire sort of bearings, I think, in part of my deep self. Pretty deep. And I enjoyed it. I should mention that The Beatles Get Back is now streaming on Disney Plus. And this was sort of like, you know, turn him on and he goes kind of thing. We were on Zoom, but I do want to tell you that there was a notification sound happening during the thing. And it was driving me nuts. Like, I was I tried to turn it off on my phone, on my computer, on my other computer. I could not figure out which one of my machines was making noise until the interview ended and I realized it was coming from Peter. It was him. And we just didn't want to bother him with trying to make the adjustment because he was on a roll. But it was a pleasure to talk to him. It was interesting to hear some of the process of being with the Beatles as long as he was on film and why he made some of the choices he did. So this is me talking to Peter Jackson. What a nice framing you've got there. Are you in your castle?
I'm in just a house on the coast in New Zealand. Just
right out your window makes me want to live there.
Yeah, I know. It's all green and nice, yeah.
Yeah.
And there's boats. You probably can't see there's a harbour with the yachts and the boats. And it's all very, very peaceful and nice.
Did you grow up by there?
I grew up about 20 miles away, yeah. Yeah, just up the coast.
So you're no stranger to boats.
I hate boats.
You do?
Oh, yeah.
No. You grew up on an island.
I used to be in the Boy Scouts, and then our Boy Scout unit in this little town I was in, they wanted to become a Sea Scout unit. So they became Sea Scouts, and I was sort of dragged along. Had one day where I was in a boat, and I threw up all over the boat, and uh-huh. I was just in front of all the other Scouts, and then I never went back. That was the end of my scouting.
No more boats.
I get terribly seasick. But the water's nice if you see it from a distance. It's really nice.
But you have no problem with planes.
I don't really like planes too much either. I'm a nervous flyer, but
really?
I like old planes.
But do you fly yourself?
No. Oh God, no.
Oh.
I've always wanted to fly. I've always had a romantic notion, and I've got some World War One airplanes, and I've had this sort of, you know, this romantic notion of being able to fly in these First World War planes. But I just think that if an emergency happens, which I think is what you have to make your decisions based on, you know, what happens if something goes wrong.
Yeah.
And the engine stops or something. And I think I just panic. I don't understand engines. I don't understand oil pressure. I don't know any of that stuff. So I think when the emergency happens, I'd freeze, panic, and go straight into the ground. So I've never really, I just don't have a natural affinity with that sort of thing. So I fly in planes, but I don't fly them.
But you like the machines. You have a passion for the planes themselves.
I have a passion for history in the First World War. In particular, I guess. I mean, other parts of history. And for some reason, I grew up. Well, when I was young, I saw a movie called The Blue Max.
Oh, yeah. Was that Mike? Was it Max von Sydow or somebody?
No, who was George it? Papard.
George Papard, right? Yeah.
And Ursula Andress, of course. Which when you're 12 years old, she's
enough.
A goddess.
Yeah.
And so between Ursula Andress and the planes, it made a huge impression on me, and I did end up building some First World War planes, and I've got a little collection of those. So yeah.
So what do you just have a guy when you want to go look at him? You got a friend who go fly him around for you?
Yeah. Well, I've got a little kind of a team who look after them. You know, I've got some engineers because they all have to pass inspections and things, and then when they fly into the air shows, we've got a little group of volunteer pilots that fly them. But I actually the plane that George Papard flies in the Blue Max, about 10 years ago, I found that in a barn in the States. You know, it was in a very bad condition. So, and I've restored it. So I've actually got the exact plane that he flew in that movie. So,
well, that's exciting.
It is. Yeah.
Do you like model planes as well?
Well, it began with models. It began with the little 1/72nd Revell and Airbix models, and then it sort of expanded into full size planes. Yeah.
Do you know the comic Jonathan Winters? He was a kind of an improvisational wizard.
Mad World. The guy.
Yeah.
I know him.
I interviewed him when he was, you know, near death, and I went to his house in Santa Barbara, and we were after we talked. He goes, "Let me show you the planes," and he walks me down the hallway to his bedroom, and he's got this 4-poster bed, but on the ceiling he had about 100 model planes hanging.
Wow.
And it was like It's like he was like 7 years old. He just he was so proud of them. He loved them.
And the planes that he'd built and painted them and done.
I don't know if I got that far. I just know that they were hanging there and he loved them. Yeah. And it's very weird what people remember when you talk about nostalgia, which is sort of, you know, what we're going to be talking about in a way, is that, you know, I walked him down that hallway, that old guy who'd had a life in show business, and there was a hallway just filled with pictures with him and everybody you could think of from the history of show business all along this wall. And he stops and he points at a picture, and it's of a little kid. It's a black and white picture that was barely, it was very grainy, a little kid and a dog. And he just said, "I miss that dog." Out of all the pictures of his entire life, the thing that he held on to were these planes and that little dog. It was so touching. You know, what we hold on to.
Yeah. It was probably a childhood dog. I would
Right. But after the walking down that hall of everybody, it was just such a beautiful moment, the things that make an impact on us when we're young. And I guess that's sort of what's driven a lot of your, you know, what drove the beginning of your film career, too, was a sort of nostalgia for something you saw when you were a kid, right?
Well, my partner, Fran, reminds me whenever I need a little tilling off or something, she's quick to remind me that I'm still 10, that I have no interests or hobbies that I didn't have at the age of 10 or 12. Well, I have Fran, which I guess didn't, because I didn't know who when I was 10 or 12.
Well, that's not a hobby, that's a person.
No, but all my everything I'm interested in, all my passions, I are the same ones that I had when I was 10 or 12. I haven't actually developed at all as a human being since then, so.
Well, is that something that bothers you, or you're okay with it? I imagine.
I'm very, very happy. I love being 12. No, it's so great. I mean, I seriously can you know, in the lockdown that we had in New Zealand last year, you know, we were locked down for like 7 weeks.
Yeah.
And we couldn't work. And I thought, well, what am I going to do? You know, in the house. And so I remembered when I was 16 or 17, I tried to build Ray Harryhausen stop motion models. And I kind of, you know, back then I tried and I wasn't very happy. And then I got busy and I got school and work and everything else took over. So I thought, well, I mean, here I am, 2020. I could spend my 7 weeks trying to build them again. So look, I'll show you, I've got them here actually. So I built a couple of skeletons.
Oh wow! Yeah, like those are those like the Voyage of Sinbad.
Yeah. So they've all got armatures in them, and
yeah. Oh, look at that with the shields and
my lockdown project. So I went back to finishing off a project that I abandoned when I was about 16. So yeah.
Are you going to use them? Are you going to shoot them?
Well, yeah, because I also, when I was 16, I shot film of me as Sinbad.
Yeah,
super 8. So I had a shirt and pants and a wooden sword, and I was fighting.
Yeah,
I'm invisible. Yeah, you know, thing because I was always intending to animate the skeleton and superimpose it in. But at that point in time, it was all far too hard. So I've still got that film of the 16-year-old me.
Oh, good.
Fighting an invisible skeleton. So the idea is to Probably over Christmas, when I got some time, I'll animate those into my old film, which is so easy to do with green screen and all that sort of stuff now. So I'll finally finish off a movie that I began when I was 16. So it'll be good.
Wow, that's the longest production schedule ever, right there.
Yeah, probably.
But
I mean, I just have no interest in. I mean, everything I love really is from that period of time, you know. It's First World War, planes, Ray Harryhausen monsters, movies, Super 8 films, and making movies. It's just, you know, Beatles too.
Is that about the time? I mean, how old are you? Are you my age? How old are you?
I'm 60. I'm just turned 60.
I'm 58. So we caught the Beatles. Yeah. We were very young. I remember, my experience in watching that thing is very interesting. And I imagine everybody's having some sort of experience, but my parents had Let It Be, had the album, and you know, the Beatles' second album and Let It Be were the two albums that were in the house when I was, you know, 5 or 6. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I remember there's something, I talked about it on the show the other day, that if you love the Beatles, you don't even think about it. It's just in your genetic structure. It's in your soul. Your relationship with the Beatles is something you can't really even understand if you have it, but if you have it, you have it.
No.
It's a, It's an odd thing. And
yes, it is.
My experience in watching the movie, and it's so weird because 2 weeks before I started watching your show or the movie, the documentary, I saw the Rolling Stones live. So I had this these two interesting experiences with these heroes of mine. One of them I can still see, but the feeling of sadness and humanization of these idols of mine happened in both cases. With the Stones, it's sort of like, people are like, were they amazing? I'm like, no, they're old and they're still doing what they do. And it's nice, mm-hmm. but it's sad, mm-hmm. you know, and they're painfully human. Whereas with yes. your thing, you know, you watch that thing, it's like, there is a sadness to it. But the thing I couldn't get past was that, like, it was almost like I've already known them my whole life. And there was part of me that wasn't surprised at all by anything that was happening. It was sort of like, yep, this is exactly how it should be. This is what it was. Finally, I get to hang out with them.
I know. Yeah. I felt the same way.
You did?
I was listening to a podcast the other day. Some Beatle fan thing. Just you know, and they'd seen Get Back, and one of the guys made a comment which made me laugh, because he was, you know, the same sort of thing. You know, I felt that I'd gone back and spent time with them and all that, and he said, God, he said, I have to get used now that I'm living in a world that where a 27-year-old McCartney and a 79-year-old McCartney exist in the same world.
Yeah,
which is kind of it does play games with your head in that way. Really,
well, it's weird for me. Like, I find it hard. Like, I tend to develop some sort of, I guess it's probably my own fear of mortality, because I've interviewed Paul and I've interviewed Keith Richards at different times, but. Mm. I start to get, you know, not so much with Keith, but weirdly, I'm a John guy. I mean, when I went to interview Paul, which is a big deal, he's a Beatle, but in my mind, I'm like, I'm still a John guy. Like, I'm happy I'm going to interview Paul, but like, he's not my guy. And what was it like? How much interaction did you have with him for the process?
Oh, well, I mean, I could have as much as I needed. I mean, I didn't need a huge amount apart from just asking him questions. Like, there's that little sequence where he appears to concoct get that back out of thin air. He just strums his bass.
Yeah.
Song comes. So I saw that clip and I sent it to him and I said, is this what I think it is? I said, did you have any idea about the song beforehand? Did you have a snippet of the song in your head to come in? And he saw the clip, because he couldn't remember the exact moment. So he looked at the clip that I sent him, and he said, no, that's me making it up.
Pulling it out of the air.
Yeah, so he could recognize what he was doing. So, I mean, he was always available for those sorts of things. So I knew that I had my facts straight. But why are you a John guy? What's the reason for that?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, as I grow up with it and I think about it, because like when I was in high school, I remember I spent hours drawing a picture of his face. I think it was from the Sgt. Pepper period, and I won an award for it. I mean, I spent hours and hours, you know, on this John face, and I think because I relate to his sensitivity and to his emotional volatility. I think I relate to it without really knowing it. I think that whatever we're attracted to when we're younger in terms of Beatles, they probably represent some of us. I liked his wit. I think I knew innately he was, you know, an angry guy and probably a sad guy. And, you know, I have to backload that, because I assume that's what it is. I mean, Paul's great and I understand Paul's great, but he always seemed
he always seemed like the showbiz Beatle.
Also, like, you know, the type of music he liked was kind of like, you know, marching band stuff. But the one thing I loved about watching the documentary is, like, they love rock and roll, those guys.
Yeah.
They're only like, you know, you got to figure you're only 10, 11 years away from the beginning of rock and roll in earnest. So, you know, them sitting around playing Wilbur Harrison or whoever, Blue Suede Shoes or whatever it is, I mean, you know, that's only like 10 years ago. Those are songs that they, you know, that's how they learned their chops, and they just love it.
I mean, they had this strange experience of loving rock and roll. And then before they became famous, their rock and roll heroes all kind of imploded. You know, Elvis went into the army. Little Richard had issues. Chuck Berry had issues.
Yeah.
Buddy Holly was killed.
Yeah.
So by the time they were playing in Hamburg and in the Cabin Club, their rock and roll heroes had kind of gone.
Oh, that's brutal. I never thought of that.
They had a strange experience. And I heard an interview that was done with John after they met Elvis, because they went to L.A. in 64, 65. And they had their famous night with Elvis. And I found an interview with John the day after. And the guy said to John, so what did you and Elvis talk about? And John says, well, I just told him that I preferred his records before the Army, and can he please do some more of those?
Yeah.
So that was John's chat with Elvis.
Yeah. Wild.
Yeah.
So now what, walk me through the, you know, what compelled you to do this? I mean, where did it come from? Because I remember, like, it was weird when I watched when I was going to talk to you the first time, I'd only seen what the press set out, that 1 hour thing that you, like the hour long trailer. Oh, yeah. And I realized seen that footage of John and Yoko dancing, because I had seen the original documentary when I was in high school. So what made you decide to do this?
Well, I've been a Beatles fan since I was about 12.
So. Right.
So I just like living my life as an adult, as I said, but I'm just, you know, still following my passions as a kid. So I don't have any interest in sort of doing sort of grown up stuff, really. And but I never really dreamt that I'd be doing any things with the Beatles, because you sort of think at this point in time, you know, what is there to do?
Yeah.
But it was weird, because I was working on this World War One film, They Shall Not Grow Old.
I saw that.
And normally I'm New Zealand based, but that made me take several trips to London to go into the archives and look for film and stuff. So I was also, I'm just piecing it together. I can't quite remember the how or why, but I was also doing interviews, I guess, at the time where I was expressing an interest in the technology VR and AR, you know, with the glasses and you put them on, you see things, which I'm still interested in, but it hasn't kind of taken off yet. But anyway, the guys at Apple Corps, the Beatles Apple, not the other Apple.
Yeah.
They must have seen that. They must have heard an interview, because I never met them before, and they must have heard that I was in London for some reason. I don't know how. So anyway, I get an invitation I get a request. Could I pop into Apple and meet with Geoff Jones and Jonathan Clyde, because they at that point they had a Beatles exhibition, a live sort of exhibition that they were thinking about doing. From what I could understand, and never got very far, I mean, it's not going to happen, but from what I could understand, it was like you walk into an exhibition hall and you see original costumes and guitars.
Right. Yeah.
And you see a replica of the Cavern Club, and it was sort of like a walkthrough thing. And so they were interested in using VR or AR technology, so that you know, in the doorway, you'd be given some glasses and you go through and you see Beatles doing things. So they just wanted to pick my brains about where the technology was at. So it was just really a meet and a chat. And so anyway, I show up at Apple, and it's, you know, I mean, it's very small. The company's very, very small as are we down here. So, you know, it felt nice. It's like a sort of homely place where there's Beatle posters everywhere and photographs everywhere. And I was all wow. And I was thinking, don't act like a fan. Don't act like a fan. You're here to talk about AR and VR. So for God's sake, just be a pro. So anyway, I sat in the room and I chatted with them about the AR, VR thing, sort of gave them a brief description of what you could do with it. And then I had one fan question that I had for years and years and years that I wanted to ask. And so I just slipped it in and said, oh, by the way, if you're needing some footage of the Beatles that no one's ever seen before, whatever happened to the outtakes from Let It Be? But I had no idea how much survived, if it had all been junked, I just didn't know. So they said, oh no, we've got it all. We've got 60 hours of film.
Oh,
we've got about 140 hours of audio. And then they said, oh, it's strange that you should mention this, because we had a meeting the other day and we're thinking about, but perhaps we should do a film that uses the outtakes. And they were just finishing up eight days a week at that time, and I was sort of in the last year or so of They Shall Not Grow Old. And so I did the one thing that I've never ever done in my life. I stuck up my hand and I said, if you're looking for a filmmaker, if you haven't got somebody attached yet, just please think of me. And so that was really weird. They disappeared into another room And they came back and they said, if you want to do it, do it. It's all yours.
Oh my God.
And so I kind of walked into the meetings to give them some thoughts about AR and VR. And I walked out with Get Back, but even then I didn't want to commit to it because I knew the reputation of the project, of the misery and the squabbles, and, you know, all the books that I read said that they couldn't stand each other's company, and you know all the really bad stuff.
Right, so right.
At that point, I said, "Well, how can I look at this stuff?" And they said, "Well, we've got it on a server. You know, it was all very the security was all very. I mean, they weren't going to give it to me to take home. And so at that point, I extended my trip in London. I was supposed to be working on They Shall Not Grow Old, but I took a leave of absence for a week.
Uh-huh.
Extended my trip, and I went into Apple every single day. And they had an office for me, and so I'd arrive at 8 in the morning, and I'd sit there till 6.
Oh my God!
And they'd go fetch me burgers and stuff for lunch.
What was the first feeling, man? I mean, when you first turned it on?
It was dread. It was dread because I totally bought into the reputation of the Let It Be period.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking, what the hell am I going to see? Because I kept thinking, if Let It Be, which I had seen and was pretty familiar with. If Let It Be was what they allowed Michael Lindsay Hogg to show, what the hell did they not want him to show? What horrors am I going to see?
Right.
Because you don't want, you know, because people you admire, I could call them heroes, but, when I was younger, they were heroes, but as I got older, they were just people that I, you know, whose skill and talent I admired. Their story was great. I didn't want to see the real people because I was terribly worried that the real, you know, whenever you meet your heroes, they're not what you hope they'd be. I was excited because this film had never been seen by anybody for 50 years. So, I mean, I was immensely curious, but I was also dreading it. And I said to the guys, look, if this film is as bad as what it's supposed to be in terms of the mood and the atmosphere and everything else, I'm probably not going to do it. I said, I can't believe I'm saying this because doing a Beatles film is a lifelong dream of mine, but I really don't want to do a Beatles film with full of argument and misery and depressed Beatles. That's not the film I want to do.
How long did it take you before you realized that wasn't the case?
It was a slow unveiling because I didn't have any script. I mean, there's no actual script, and there's no paperwork. They had the film organized day by day, so it starts on the first day, second of and it was 60 hours of film at that point. The audio they didn't sort of I wasn't hearing that. It was just the film with the audio with the film.
Yeah.
It was 60 hours to go through, and so it was a slow process where each day I'd sit there for 7 or 8 hours and watch it for 7 or 8 hours, get through day one. You know, I'd come in the next day, I'd be on day two. The next day, day three has got the argument or the thing with Paul and George, you know, so I watched that and I thought, well, this isn't actually as bad. You know, the I'll play anything you want or I won't play at all. You just tell me what you want me to do. You know, I watched the whole thing. And in our movie, it's about we've extended it to about eight or nine minutes, but the actual thing is about an hour and a half long. That sequence. So I just watched it. And I thought, okay, well, like, this is building up to that little exchange that I've seen, and let it be. And this is not feeling too bad. And then the famous words happen, and then it carries on. And I'm thinking, well, that's actually kind of not as bad as I thought it was. And then, but I was still waiting for the stuff that Michael wasn't allowed to, you know, the stuff that where they're swearing at each other or they're shouting or they're throwing things or God knows what. And it just never happened. And it got funnier and funnier.
Yeah.
It just got funny. And I was laughing. And I got through up to about when George left the band in that first week. And so I didn't get into Savile Row. I got the first 7 days, and I said to them, look, I have to fly home, but I'm really keen to do it. And you're going to have to send it to me. You're going to have to break all your security protocols. You're going to have to trust me, and you're going to have to send me the whole thing because I've only seen, you know, the first 7 hours. I need to keep on watching it, but it looks great. And I knew that from what I'd read in the books that the Savile Row stuff was going to get better. So I thought, well, this is actually pretty funny. And if Savile Row's better, it's great. So they sent it to me. I had it on an iPad and I watched it and it took me a few weeks to get through it all. And then I watched it again twice.
Yeah,
because you know you watch it once and you don't pick up all the little the little clues about stuff that's gonna happen later on.
Right,
so I had
right,
to go
right.
back and watch it again, and then I slowly built up this picture in my head of this of what I assumed was more like the truth of that month, and that coincided about that moment in time when I'd seen it a couple of times. Paul comes down to New Zealand to do a concert. December 2017 it was. So they arranged for me to go meet Paul. So he was the first Beatle that I met on the for the project. And I go to the meeting before a show, and he looks at me and I say, "Well, Paul, I've seen all the outtakes."
Yeah.
And I mean, he hadn't seen them. He had a memory of whatever his memory of, which is pretty grim.
Emotional. It's an emotional memory, different.
Well,
right?
It's a memory of May 1970. It's a memory of the breaking up and Let It Be coming out, and it's not a memory of January 1969. So, as I discovered with quite a few of the people, but so I said to Paul, "Look, I've seen the whole lot. I've seen every single frame of film," and
right.
he looked nervous. He really looked. He had a really sort of almost childlike, frightened look on his face. And I just said to him, "Look, whatever you think it is, and I know what you think it is, the same as what I thought it is, it's not that. It's actually really, really great. It's really funny. It's you know, and there's friendship and everything else." And I had my iPad, which I had the footage on, so I showed him some bits, and he was so relieved. He was so happy. I mean, this was not to do with the movie or anything at this point. He was just happy to hear that the film that was shot didn't show fighting, squabbling, swearing at each other, arguments, which I guess in his head over the period of time he'd built that picture in his head, because I think everybody had taken the movie Let It Be at its release in May 1970. The headlines are saying the Beatles are breaking up, and they've taken that as a core, and they've extrapolated that, you know, time has passed, it's gotten worse over time.
Yeah.
The outtakes must be really, really bad. The whole thing is sort of built from that May 1970 moment in time when the film came out after they'd broken up. And it has no relation with the January 69 filming at all.
Well, I think like what's amazing to me in watching it is like, I don't know why I didn't bring any of that baggage to it. Like I didn't really put it in my head. I didn't frame it historically. I just sort of entered it. I knew that they were going to break up soon. So I didn't go in with any of the dread that you had. I just like, I took it at face value. And I thought all the friendships were intact, and I thought maybe they were, you know, probably, I wonder if they ever really yelled and screamed, because they're pretty British, all of them.
Well, on the 150 hours of audio, because the real story is actually in the Nagra tapes and the audio.
Yeah.
You know, which they rolled audio almost all day long. And I've certainly, you know, I mean, I don't know what happened, in the evenings or at the weekends or anything else, but certainly during those 22 days, listening to the audio, which is pretty much starting in the beginning of the day and going through to the end, and they had an A/B machine, so if one had to change the tapes, the other one was going. There was not one moment where a Beatle had an angry word to another Beatle.
Yeah.
Not one moment where one of them swore at each other. I mean, they swear a lot, but they swear in a sort of funny Scouse way. They don't actually swear in an aggressive way. So, but there's no shouting.
Yeah, I didn't feel it at all. I mean, I felt sad. I felt sad, you know, because I knew that, as you probably knew, you know, John was struggling with his addiction problems, and you know, George was unhappy creatively. But I didn't bring any of that to. I kind of noticed that during it, and I didn't realize that John was in the throes of the addiction that he was in until after I watched it, and Paul was Paul, and even Yoko, like from the get-go, like I was able to sort of not pay attention to her at all, which I think a lot of them did, and it seemed like that this idea that she was hanging over this band, she almost like became furniture. I mean, it's a very
she does for sure. But you see, up until this film has come out, what you've seen of Yoko has been either little tiny, you know, 10-second film clips.
Yeah.
Where there's a band and there's her, and you immediately go, oh my God, she's sitting right there. Or still photos, you know, and for 50 years it's been little clips or still photos. And you're right, it's only when you see the enormity of the length, which is 8 hours and looked up some, that it's just like you just realize, well, so what? She's quiet. She doesn't interfere.
Yeah.
She doesn't tell Paul how to play his bass. It's just what the hell is the issue? Right, you know. Right. And you know, but it's a very different story to the 50 years of these photos that you see in books of.
Yeah, you thought this was going to be it, you know, and also there's moments with her and Linda that were kind of genuine and wives of the band kind of moments, it didn't stifle any of the creativity. Now, when you see all this footage and you start going through it, tell me why, you know, what did you do to it, Peter? What was the magic you did to it that made me feel like I was hanging out there? That made, there was no, the emotional interface was so immediate. Is there some way that you treated the film? Did you take out any, like, I don't know, like, I know there's the magic of the Beatles, but it's a lot to sit through 8 hours of guys, you know, doing, you know, bits and pieces of songs, even if it is the Beatles. But there was points where I picked up my guitar on my couch or I'd go get something to eat. And I'm just sort of like, well, they're just doing that now. What did you do? Yeah. How did you visualize? I can hear how you were starting to put the story together, but how did you visualize the effect of the film itself?
Well, I think the effect of the film itself is tied to the story. I mean, you can restore the film, but you've still got to have the story, because I think, you know, the sense that you're with them and you're sort of going on this journey with them is also story related. But in terms of the technical stuff, we'd done this First World War movie where we'd restored this old 100-year-old footage, you know, which was pretty hard because black and white, scratchy, and
you did this at your magic lab,
Park Road Post, which is about a mile down the road here in Wellington. Yeah, very small team, but a really really talented team, very 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 clever. And we're sort of just down the other end of the world, so we don't care what anyone else does. We just develop our own code, our own software, and our own team, and we just. And we go for it. So anyway, we'd done the World War One film, and what had happened after, as we were going through this towards the end of the First World War, the First World War film, I had my first three movies, which I made when I was younger, sort of
the horror movies,
splatter movies, were all shot on a 16mm. They've never come out in any sort of a restored form.
Yeah,
you know, they got released in. On VHS, basically, in the 1980s, early 90s. So I said to the guys, I said, God, I love, while we're on a roll here, I'd love to get my old 16mm films.
Well, like Meet the Feebles?
And Bad Taste and Brain Dead, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I said, I'll get the original neg for the 16mm stuff. It's not the World War One. It's, you know, it's color. It's 16mm neg. And it'd be great if you guys could start to work on that. So we just begun that when the Beatles thing arrived. So we'd already switched our sort of pipeline from the World War One 35mm sort of nitrate sort of thing to 16mm color based on my old horror movies, and I was shooting on pretty much the same sort of film that the Beatles shot on. So it's a case of just, you know, the concept with removing the grain and trying to make it look as sharp as I can, it was actually a deliberate one. You know, people sort of, you know, have opinions about it and stuff, and there's film grain enthusiasts that hate the idea that all the film grain is gone and everything else, but I had a very definite goal in mind, because what I wanted, you know, as I was looking at the film and before we got started, because Apple kept saying to me, what's the story? What's the story you're going to tell? And I was saying, well, hang on, let me see it first. Let me see it and have a think. But I, you know, I always as a kid fantasized, you know, as I was a young Beatles fan, fantasized that surely when, you know, as a 16-year-old Beatles fan, I assumed that by the time I got to be an old bastard like I am now, a time machine will have been invented, and, you know, and maybe we get to pick a day to go back. And I thought, well, you know, I don't know exactly what day, but I'm going to go back to Abbey Road, and I'm going to sit in the corner of the studio and spend a day watching the Beatles at work. That was my, if we could all pick a time machine trip, just one, that would have been mine. I'd have to figure out what album exactly to do it on. So I just looked at the stuff and I thought, God, this is like a time machine, but it's not like a time machine when it's grainy and scratchy, because it's like, you know, there's a film of film.
Then the film becomes something unto itself, not what's on the film.
Well, it becomes that, look, we found 50-year-old film. Right. you know, of the Beatles, and look, it's old and it's got grain, but it's but it's them, and isn't that cool? So I thought, if I really want to pull off this time machine thing, I've got to remove as much between us and them.
Yeah.
And that involves removing all any scratches, any imperfections, any hairs in the gate, in the grain. Try to make it look as crisp and clean as I can. And if I can do that, then hopefully we'll feel like we're in the room with them. And that was also the reason why I made a decision early on not to do any modern day interviews, not to interview Ringo or Paul or Glyn Johns or anyone else, because that immediately is the 50-year gap again. I just wanted to get in the time machine, take any interested parties along with me, any Disney Plus subscribers, I guess, at this point in time. And we'll all go and watch them at work. And so I wanted to, you know, look, it's all weird headspace stuff, but that was, I just, you know, that was the thought behind doing all the, you know, to restore it to the level that we did.
Well, and also I think that the decision not to engage with any of the survivors, I mean, you would run into the liability of the emotional liability of that 50-year gap again. That, like, obviously most of these guys have you know, reframed that memory, you know, based on events that happened afterwards. So, like, why screw with the purity of what you already had? And there's so much space there.
Well, you see, that then went on to the narrative, then to the storyline, because, of course, taking on this project, there's no script. You know, normally when I make a movie, you've got, you know, you go into you go and you cut the movie, you know. You finally get into the cutting room to cut it.
Yeah.
And at that point, you've written the script. Every scene has got a number. There's a story. There's a 3-act structure. You've shot it, you know, each day. You know every frame of film that you've shot. You know the best takes. And so the cutting is like a pretty sort of, you know, it's fun. It's my favorite part of it. But it's there's no mysterious thing to it. It's like, you know, there's surprises. But it is you're following your script. And then you're following what you shot. And then it's... But here I had you know, 130 hours of audio really in the camera just switches on and off during it. So there was like 130 hours, no script. And the thing that I realized as soon as I saw it, I realized that all the books that I'd read were very unreliable. So it wasn't like I could turn to some expert Beatle guy who's written a book and, you know, use that as my guide, because I realized just how wrong the books have been. I mean, some of the books say they couldn't bear to be in each other's company. John was off his head all the time. They were phoning it in. They were coming in with finished songs, and the others were just acting as. I mean, every negative spin that you could imagine has been put on this. So I couldn't rely on books. So I had Jabez Olsen, who I cut it with, just the two of us, we sat in a room for, well, it was months really. And we listened to the 130, 40 hours, and we listened to it again. And we had to build up our own storyline from what they were saying. So we were eavesdropping on 50-year-old conversations that they had no idea were going to be heard by us in 50 years' time. And we were trying to figure out what's the truth? What is actually happening? Why are they there? What are they doing? What's going wrong? Why does George leave? Why do they go to separate? You know, why? And the answers were all coming from things that they were saying. So it wasn't until we went through the audio like twice that we pieced together what we thought was the actual, you know, more or less the a much more accurate narrative. And then we decided we'll just tell the story day by day.
So for you, like, an example of that would be George leaves and you track it back to them, you know, not listening to their songs, his songs, in a serious way.
Well, George leaving is interesting because we you know, there's a day where he has his little sort of tetchy exchange with Paul. That's day three. I mean, I don't know the dates, so I just say day 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So that's day three. George doesn't leave till day 7. So like, I spoke to Ringo and I said, why did George leave? And he said, well, you've seen it in the film, in the Let It Be movie. He, you know, he and Paul had, George and Paul had these angry words and he got up and left. And I said to Ringo, no, that happened on day 3, Ringo, and he didn't leave till day 7. And Ringo said, no, he had those. And I just thought, I'm not going to argue with Ringo.
Yeah.
Because he's actually, I mean, again, it's just his memory had muddled up the movie with the facts. And that's fine. It's a long, long time ago. So So anyway, George has a little exchange on day three. Day four, he's you know, George is reasonably happy. Day five, he's very, very happy because they do I Me Mine and they have some fun.
Yeah.
Day six, he's having a great day. They're doing Commonwealth and they're clowning around and doing bathroom window, and George is having a good time. So
yeah.
So Jayla and I are looking at this stuff and say, well, he's going to leave tomorrow. Just watching all the day six stuff. Well, he's going to leave tomorrow. Why is he, you know, where are the clues? There's no arguments.
Yeah.
So we get on to day seven, and day seven starts with Dick James, the publisher, the Northern Songs guy, being there for a meeting. George comes in a bit late and thanks him for the glasses that he gave him over Christmas.
Yeah.
And then they get working on two songs. They start with Get Back and they go into Two of Us. And we did a really a forensic examination, because we could tell from the Nagras where if our time was a cut. We could tell if the tape machines had been turned off. We could because of the coding on the tapes and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, the actual film that was shot just turns on and off all the time. But the sound, you can track the actual time of the day that the tapes run. And I had our guys examine it, and I said, okay, so we're start with they're doing Get Back. They spend about 3 hours after Dick James leaves.
Yeah.
And then they break for lunch, and George says, I'm leaving now. And I said, is there any break? Is there anything that where they could have had an argument where the tapes didn't roll? And they said, no, this some sound is continuous. There's no stoppages in the audio. And so Jabez and I looked at it over and over again. I mean, the audio's there, and there's a fair bit of film shot. And it just looked like, well, to us, it looked like George was in a very depressed state.
Yeah.
Right at the beginning of the day. He arrived. And from what we can understand, and we didn't want to actually get into this, and maybe he was having some domestic issues at home.
With Patty.
Patty had just walked out on him.
Wasn't that involving Eric Clapton too?
That was a little bit later. I think okay. that was another year. I think this was some other thing. But I, you know, that's not what I'm. I mean, I've never been interested in the Beatles' private life.
Yeah, yeah.
And I certainly didn't want to make a movie that, because there's obviously none of that's on film, and I wanted just to stick with what we had filmed. So we don't cover it in Get Back, but. From what I've understood, he was having some pretty serious domestic trouble.
Right.
And then you add on to that, you know, you can add on to that as much of the disrespect from the other two, and they're not interested in the songs, which is not really true, because they, I mean, All Things Must Pass, they do like 67 takes of it.
I know.
I mean, we show one take.
Oh, so they really tried.
And Get Back. They spend at least the best part of two entire days working on it, or at least, you know.
You could definitely feel the love. Like when I watched Above Us Only Sky, you know, the Imagine documentary, there was a moment that goes unspoken between John and George where you're like, they were so deeply connected in a way that, you know, I can't even fathom or understand musically and emotionally, that, you know, and you felt that, you know, I felt that through the entire thing, that, you know, they all knew each other pretty well and they all had their roles, I guess. But emotionally, they were very fluid and very connected. And I never felt once that, you know, there was, you know, real hostility on behalf of any of them towards the others.
No. So we studied George that in the morning, and we studied him so carefully, and we looked at the film we had. There was no trigger. There's no moment where they, you know, Paul says a bit, he's a little bit blunt. He talks about something about how to play the bass, how to play the guitar.
Yeah.
I think it's Get Back. I mean, but it's not rude or anything. It's just a little bit. And George doesn't take it very, very well. He says, you need Eric Clapton for that. You know, and John
says,
that
was just insecure, though.
Yeah, it is. You see, because everybody's a human, and I think everyone looks for black or white, and it's never black or white. It's always shades of grey. So I think you've got George being a bit insecure, and you've certainly got him maybe feeling that he's only ever going to get two songs on an album, no matter how great his songs are, and he's now writing a lot. So you've got sort of things behind the scenes. You know, you've got a sense that they're not respecting his songs, perhaps to some degree. And then if you've got stuff at home, if you've got a domestic crisis, you're going to sit there thinking, I could sit here all day with these guys and, you know, doing Get Back, doing doing their songs, because they're not going to do All Things That Must Pass Away. Yeah. Or I could just leave and go sort out my home life,
right,
because I've got some issues I need to sort out. So I just kind of think that George sits there that morning looking exactly like he does in the film. I mean, those shots that we did where Paul and John are clowning around and they're in each other's faces, and George is just sitting there separate, looking pretty depressed. That is the real footage from that day. It's, I mean, you know, we had, because we couldn't cheat shots from one day to the next because there are clothes
changeable
time. So you know, that morning George was sitting there exactly as you see him, separate from the others. He just feels, and it just so happens that they're working on two songs. John and Paul are working on two songs right up in there, you know, close. Get back and two of us are songs that don't really, you know, they're not really interested in George's input at this point. So he, he looks like he's sort of on the outer, but I think he's also feeling that himself. He's sort of adding to it as well. So, and it's the most George-like thing when he leaves. I think I'm leaving the band now. I love the way he says, I think I'm leaving the band now.
Was he your favorite Beatle?
No, I didn't really have a favorite Beatle, although I like George. I like them all after the footage, but I understand George a lot more from
right
now that I've seen this footage. George reminds me of a Kiwi, a New Zealand male, a very, very pragmatic, no romantic sort of flights of fancy.
Yeah,
you know when John and Paul are saying, "I will go into the amphitheatre when we'll get the QE2 and we'll take all the fans." George says, "That's a bloody stupid idea.
Yeah.
Who's going to pay for it?" You know, George is always that guy.
Yeah,
and in a film set or any you know that guy is a really important guy to have. The one that stops all the visionary kind of talk and just cuts it. Says that's never going to happen.
Going
to be far too expensive. Those people are very, very important and important people to have. And so you've got the sort of John and Paul doing the visionary kind of stuff. The spacing out on all the amazing things it could be. And George is just a pragmatic one. Who's going to pay for that? That's never going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, which makes him seem grumpy, but he's not grumpy. He's just, you know. He's just saying what needs to be said. So I actually love George. I love George a lot more now that I understand him, because he was always a quiet Beatle, lead guitarist. But now I can see he's very insecure too. It's interesting when his own songs are up, you know, for rehearsal. He's very, very nervous and insecure. But if it's Get Back or Dig a Pony, he's got all sorts of ideas. He's incredibly confident. He can improve the songs and he suggests things.
Sure.
And John and Paul are really happy to get his own notes. But when it's his own song, he's very, very insecure and nervous. You know, you just have to feel for him. He's just a human being.
Well, they're not even 30 years old. I mean, of course he's insecure. Let me ask you a question about these about the credits. Like, you know, you had all these fragments of songs that seemed to be that needed to be attributed. What was that? Why was that?
I mean, that was me. It wasn't anybody telling me to do it. I just thought that. I mean, if it was me watching it, because I'm not a huge musical guy. I mean, I like the Beatles. I don't really know much else about anybody else. I'm a musical,
single band guy.
I'm a musical moron, basically. Yeah. So I just thought if I'm watching this and I hear a fragment of a song that I don't recognize, I'd be thinking, is that an unknown Lennon McCartney song, or is it a Chuck Berry song, or is it a Little Richard song? What's that? I just know that I'd be immediately wondering. So yeah. I didn't want anyone to do the same as that. I just wanted to answer. So if you hear a fragment of a song and it's quite good, and the Beatles only do a line or two, if you've got the name, then you can go by the Chuck Berry album or
the
Little Richard album,
sure,
and hear the whole thing. So it was just really a sort of informational thing. It wasn't a legal thing or anything. It was just done.
And how excited were you when it was beautiful. I mean, you must have been excited too, where, you know, they mention, you know, working with Little Richard and seeing Billy Preston early on, and that Billy Preston's going to show.
We know what's going to happen. Yeah.
How great was that?
Yeah, I know. It's incredible. I know.
And he changed everything, Billy.
Yeah. I know. Billy is fantastic. I mean, I didn't really have an appreciation of Billy separate to the Beatles. I knew, you know, I mean, I knew his work on the, because I've heard the songs for 40 years and I read the books, but I didn't, but I haven't seen Billy in any other, way. I haven't, got any of his albums or anything. So I, so I knew that he was, and I knew that he was always credited as really, uplifting their spirits and stuff. I knew that from the books I'd read, but it wasn't until I saw it on film that I just thought, holy shit.
Yeah.
they, and it's not that, because I don't like, a lot of the books say that he came in so that, and they began to behave themselves. Or, a lot of the books sort of say that it was when Billy arrived, they stopped sniping at each other and they stopped and they had to behave because there was a fifth person in the room. But that's just not true, because they were getting on fine before Billy came in. But what Billy gave them is this rush of excitement. He just gave them, their songs are just lift.
Yeah,
they go from being what they've been rehearsing, and they're suddenly Billy's playing. And they and it's their songs getting improved by his playing, and so John and Paul are just so thrilled.
Yeah,
and it's just this rush of excitement. And Billy's such a he's an incredible guy. I mean, I don't really understand any music, but he just seems to sit there and nail it.
Yeah,
nail it. Go.
And it filled out the songs. Like he said that, I don't remember who said it was it John or Paul who said that they wanted piano in all the songs. They wanted it there.
Yeah.
And I had no idea how much bass John played. It took me a while to realize that Fender six string, that was a Fender six string bass, that he plays a lot of bass on that record.
Yeah. They played bass if Paul was on the blues and the grand piano. Yeah. Yeah. But you see, I was very careful in the film. Like I said to Jabez, okay, well, when Billy arrives and they say hi and then they say, sit there, and he sits there and he's playing. I said, we got to make sure that the first time in the movie that we see him play has got to be the actual first time he plays, because I didn't want to, I was very aware that I could, because he comes at lunchtime. So there's about four or five hours of him playing. I said, I don't want to, I don't want him to sit there and then we suddenly cut to a take he does at 4:30 in the afternoon after, to give I said, we got to make sure that the first time we see him play is the real first time he plays. I was pretty careful at being responsible for, because I said that's it's important from a historical perspective that we're not playing games here. And he sits there and he starts playing and their faces light up and they get so excited.
It's great.
And he just he's got no music, he's got no guide. I mean, they don't give him a practice run, they don't play it to him first, they just play the song and he just makes it up as he goes for the first time.
What's interesting is by the time we go through all this stuff and all this the story of heading towards the roof is that what I found shocking, after that, I'm having the experience that you were having, watching the Beatles and feeling the chemistry and having everything that you believed about this period, proven false and having a great warm feeling, but nostalgic. And then when they get to the roof, and you see the onlookers and you see people on other roofs and you see the cops and you have this weird moment. You're like, wait, doesn't everyone love the Beatles? How can these people?
Yeah.
It was a very weird thing. And then you start to realize, like, well, rock stars got in trouble all the time. And then you start to realize, like, how far they had drifted from their beginnings as, the pop group, the Beatles. But just the reception around, just on people's faces, I would have been going crazy. But most people are
it's a couple of things, because you've got to realize, and you don't think about this unless you actually stop and think about it. You got to realize that those people on the street, when they hear the music, they're hearing Get Back for the first time in their lives.
Right.
They've never ever heard it before. They're hearing all those Beatles songs, they're hearing for the very first time. So it's not like they're hearing I Want to Hold Your Hand or Sergeant Pepper. They're not hearing the oldies and goldies. They're hearing these songs that they've never heard before, but they are the Beatles. So they're not able to sort of groove with the actual songs themselves, because it's the first time that they've heard them.
But even the people on the roof, you would think they would have just been amazed, but I guess it's a different time.
They sort of are. I think they're amazed in a very British way. I mean, they do gather, they do flock, and they do sort of stand there with very straight faces. But you got to imagine inside they're really excited. But because they're British, they're not going to And the other thing I was going to say is that the Savile Row police station, because the police station that these guys come from is about 100 yards up the road, or 75 yards up the road. that was a police station where Sergeant Pilcher was a base, and he was the drug obsessed rock star planting drugs guy who had already busted John the year before. And I think who had he done? Donovan, a couple of others, and he was going to bust George a month or two later. This guy was leading British police drug pop star task force.
Uh-huh.
He was based in the same police station as these two cops come from. It was a Savile Row police station was his base. And so there's a lot of whatever these cops have been hearing back at there about the rock stars and the drugs and their they're bringing a really bad influence to modern youth. I'm sure that in the cafe in the police station, Pilcher and his other drug squad guys would have been blabbing all that stuff. So these guys are coming down, you know, with not necessarily the best impression,
sure,
of a pop group in the world. So it's the guy got busted, Pilcher, who arrested all these rock stars in 68, 69. He spent about two and a half years in jail. He got nailed for it.
For what?
For perverting the course
for planting
of justice.
Evidence,
George swears that he planted the drugs in his house. John swears that he planted drugs in his house. So yeah.
So like as a filmmaker now, given these two documentary projects, where you took these like fairly dense and epic bits of the past and thoroughly were able to extract something very humanizing out of them. Mm-hmm. How do you see that affecting your filmmaking going forward? Because when I think about you, even like going back to the splatter, the horror movies, and then on through the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit movies, that it seems like there's two films. Like there's the Heavenly Creatures, which was really kind of a mix, but it was a human story, and the Lovely Bones as well. There was fantasy elements, but it seems like you'd rather create worlds that,
right. I just don't have a plan. I don't know how to answer that. I mean, I grew up. I mean, the reason why you make horror movies when you're a young filmmaker is because you haven't got any money. I mean, the first film I made, Bad Taste, I financed myself. It cost me 17 grand and I shot it over 4 years in the weekends. But you make horror movies with a lot of splatter and blood because you don't need very good actors. You don't need a very good script. You don't need very good production design. And you can get a maximum impact by going to the butcher and getting some brains and livers and kidneys and some fake blood. I think young filmmakers tend to, and I also love horror. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I grew up on Hammer horror movies and The Evil Dead and all that stuff. So I was completely into it, but certainly horror movies are a great way to bust into the film industry because you can get big effect for little production value.
But then you
get into the phase where you're writing something that's a bit more sophisticated. You're now realizing, well, God, the script has to be good, which means we're going to need to cast it really well because we're now going to have actors who can really deliver. And it's sort of everything just gets, the stakes go up.
But okay.
I mean, Heavenly Creatures was done because I met my partner, Fran Walsh, who's my co-conspirator and all this. She and I met around the Feebles time. I showed a bad taste. I got some advice from the first kind of Bad Taste. So 1987.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, so we were together and we wrote Brain Dead and together, and we did that. And then she was very interested in this New Zealand murder case, the Parker Hume murder, where these two girls murder one of their mothers. I hadn't really heard of it, but she was really, 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 really interested in it, and had been for a long time. So she pitched me the story, which I never heard of. We went down to Christchurch where it happened, just Fran and I, and we met a lot of the people who were involved. Obviously, a lot of them, the majority of them have passed away since. We went to a lot of the locations, and she sort of helped immerse me in the true story, and we interviewed a lot of people who were involved, and we just thought, well, this would be a great film. So that was just, that was how that happened. And then Bob Zemeckis wanted us to do a episode of Tales from the Crypt, his little, he was doing a series of movies. He did a TV series, but he was doing a series of movies. This is 1995 or something. And he was going to, they were going to be labeled Tales from the Crypt, you know, films. They were going to sort of, that was the branding. And so he contacted, I think he's in How Many Creatures Were Branded or something. Yeah. And so we got our first Hollywood experience was Bob Zemeckis getting in touch and saying, do you want you guys interested in doing a Tales from the Crypt film for me? And so we just thought, wow, you know, it's Bob who we loved.
Yeah.
Who did a very good film called I Want to Hold Your Hand, by the way.
Oh yeah.
You know, and obviously all the other ones he'd done. And so we were excited. I mean, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't something we had in our mind. So we walked around for a bit. We came up with a storyline about this psychic investigator guy who you know, he's a guy who looks fake and says he can see ghosts and it looks like he's a con man, but then he really can. And anyway, it was a whole little story. We went to LA. We pitched that to Bob, and he says, "Great, we should do it." And then he said, "But I don't think it fits the Tales from the Crypt." Sort of brand particularly. It's not that I don't see it as a Tales from the Crypt movie, but let's do it as a standalone film. So that one was done, and then and then it went on to Rings and stuff.
So that's how it just works. That's how it works.
You just dribble for you trip and stagger from one film to the next. There's no grand plan really. I mean right now they haven't done They Shall Not Grow Old straight into the Beatles. I've got no idea what I'm doing next. I mean, I want to go back and restore, and because we started to restore my old films, then the Beatles showed up, and that's been on hold now for 4 years. So the immediate work for the new year is to try to finish off restoring my old films, finish off shooting my 8mm skeleton fight that I did when I was 16. So those ones I do know about, and from there on we'll just see what happens. So.
I really appreciate you talking to me today, and I love all the stuff, and I love the Beatles stuff, and I really wish you success in making those skeletons walk and dance.
I'm a bit concerned. The idea of animating them, I built them, which was fun to learn how to build them, and now I've got to learn how to animate, which does concern me. But at least it's just me and a camera and them, so all the mistakes I make can be just kept quiet, and I don't have to show it to anybody.
I want someone to do a doc of you doing that. Yeah. Well, take care of yourself, Peter. Great talking to you.
Thanks, Mark. Thank you very much.
Wow. What a ride. I hope he gets to, I hope he finishes his stop action work. What's interesting is, you know, what he wants to do over the holidays with the skeletons. It's odd. I talked to Guillermo del Toro on Thursday, and he too is looking forward to spending some time with some models. I think a Lon Chaney model that he needs to paint over the holidays. There's a little similarity, a little bit. You can watch The Beatles Get Back on Disney Plus. Let's rock out, man. Let's rock out, man. Rock, man. Boomer lives. Monkey and LaFonda. Cat angels everywhere.